You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Wednesday, July the 11th. Happy to have you along and hope you join in as we try to understand Henry Kissinger this hour. We are joined by Jeremy Suri, who is a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a senior fellow at the Center for World Affairs and the Global Economy, and author of a brand new book about Henry Kissinger, Henry Kissinger and the American Century. And he is here to help us understand why Henry Kissinger held the views he did, and not just what he did in terms of foreign policy, but why he did it. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Our numbers, if you'd like to join in with a question or a thought about Henry Kissinger and his influence on the American Century, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We welcome your thoughts and questions for our guest, Jeremy Suri, who joins us in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
What made you take on the subject of Henry Kissinger?
Two things in particular. First, I have to say I was always fascinated with him. I'm someone who grew up actually pretty much in the Reagan years, and then I grew up with the bad old days of the Cold War. And I always wanted to understand how we got to that position and how we got from that position to where we are today. And Henry Kissinger is so much at the center of that. And he's such a surprising person to see at the center of that because he's not from the usual families. He doesn't have the usual background that people in foreign policy making had before him. So that's the first reason I was really fascinated by him. And then the second thing is with some of my prior research and writing on the 60s and 70s, my prior book, I came across a lot of material about him that brought out issues, especially issues regarding his Jewish background. And its influence upon him that hadn't been covered in other books, in other thoughts, in other articles about him. And I think this material really changes the way we think about not just Kissinger, but about American society.
The work that you wrote before this book did catch the eye or ear of Henry Kissinger, didn't it?
That's right. Yes. Yeah. My prior book, which was on social movements and foreign policy change in the 60s and 70s, Power and Protest, somehow he got a hold of it. And our first meeting was when he called me into his office in New York City. I actually received an email message from his assistant asking me to come to see him. And of course, I said I'd come whenever he wanted me to come. And I met with him and he spent an hour and a half grilling and in essence putting me down for misunderstanding him.
So he then he learned that you were going to be writing this book.
That's right. At the end of that discussion, I told him I had started to think about and even to plan to write this book. And as a historian, I wanted to go back to the origins. That's what historians always do. And I love doing international research. So I was going to take my family and go to Germany for a summer to do research in the Jewish archive on his family and his local life where he grew up before he left Germany. He told me not to go. He said it was a waste of my time. But I went anyway. And while I was there, this is the Woody Allen element of doing historical research, just showing up. While I was there, he happened to make a visit. He didn't know I was going to be there. He saw me there, saw me working in the German materials. And I think that's when I won his respect. I mean, I think in his mind, that signaled that I was doing real research, not a sort of slapshot polemical work on him.
Yeah. And when he saw you, he recognized you and thought, what are you doing here?
Exactly. Exactly. Well, truth be told, with my PhD and all my titles, I spent 3 hours staking him out in Germany because when I knew he was coming, I knew he was going to go visit the old family home in Fürth, Germany. So I sat on the stoop 3 hours waiting for him. And then he saw me, and this is the only time I had him off balance. In every one of our eight meetings, he always was in control. This was the one meeting where I had him off balance because he didn't expect me to be there.
Yeah, and you said that he was kind of gruff and grouchy about it, saying, don't go there. You're not going to learn anything by going there. Why did he think that you wouldn't learn anything by going there?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. I think he knew I would learn things going there, but he didn't want me to. I think, number one, I think he's someone who hasn't come to terms with his own past. He's an 84-year-old man who spent his life in the limelight making policy for others. He has not actually had the space or given himself the time for that kind of introspection. I think he's only doing that now. And I think I caught him at the right moment in that sense. Secondly, he's very sensitive about being seen as the Jewish Secretary of State and the Jew advising President Bush in the Middle East now. And I understand why he feels that way. If you Google his name on any day, you'll find hundreds of articles about Jewish world conspiracies and Henry Kissinger. So he's very sensitive about this issue.
He did make reference to his background, though, when he was inaugurated.
Absolutely.
As Secretary of State for Richard Nixon.
Absolutely. In September 1973, when Nixon announces that Kissinger will be made not just National Security Advisor, but now Secretary of State as well, that he'll have both jobs. This is a major moment for Kissinger. He describes it in his memoir that was covering it at the time. Talk about how emotional he was at that introduction. He brings his parents, his brother, his whole family there. It's the first time he actually has an official government position at that level. Before then, he's serving simply at the pleasure of the president as an NSC advisor. Now he has a congressionally, constitutionally mandated position. First Jew ever to have that position. And what he says at the inauguration, nomination and introduction, he says, only in America could this happen. Only in America could someone from my background be standing here with the president. And by all accounts, he's visibly emotional at this moment. Now, it's important to note that in the phone conversation he has with President Nixon after that, he thanks Nixon for not mentioning his Jewishness. What stresses his immigrant background. He still doesn't want to be called a Jew, even though it's evident to everyone there. He emphasizes his immigrant background, not his Jewish background.
Didn't he bring up his Jewish background a lot, even in an anti-Semitic way?
Absolutely. It comes up all the time in the telephone conversations, in the meetings between them, in Nixon's statements about Kissinger to others. Usually not in public, though. Usually in discussions. And this is true throughout Kissinger's career. One of the things I show in the book is from day one, meaning from the day he leaves Germany, arrives in the United States, through today, he is constantly working with people who are throwing out anti-Semitic comments. Often the people who are promoting him are the anti-Semites themselves. He said to me in one interview, he said, you know, I had to spend my entire career working with people who did not like my kind. And that's the paradox. He depended upon patronage from people like Nelson Rockefeller and Richard Nixon, who, as products of their own time, were not particularly comfortable being around German Jews.
So tell us how his German Jewish background so profoundly influenced his life and his worldview.
I think it had huge influence in many ways, three in particular I would point to. One, it made him profoundly skeptical about democracy. And this is what makes him seem so un-American to us, because all Americans believe in democracy, especially good Midwesterners, right? But for Henry Kissinger, he grew up in a society that was sophisticated, Weimar Germany, that was democratic, and it was not filled with Jew haters. But when the haters came to power, and they were a small group, actually, the good citizens did nothing, and the good states around Germany did nothing either. He sees democracies as weak, cowardly, and late to act. And that comes from his own experience. Every time he writes about this, and he writes about it all the time, he is writing about it in those terms. That's the first thing. The second way it influenced him, I think, is it made him very conscious of the importance of state power. Throughout his career, when he leaves Germany, comes to the United States, he is always promoted by working with people who are part of state institutions. There never was any great movement of citizens that helped promote him. It was always people connected to state institutions. The Army makes him a citizen. The Army gives him authority that he didn't have before, as serving in the Army during World War II, and I talk about that a lot. When he gets back to the U.S., he gets into Harvard because of the GI Bill, not because Harvard University wants to admit people like him. And then his access to government is never through election. It's through powerful state figures. For Kissinger, a strong state is necessary for the protection of people of weak backgrounds, of minority backgrounds, etc. And then the third thing I would say about how his German-Jewish background affects him is he has a belief in leadership. He is a believer from his study of German cultural tradition and the importance of intellectual elitism. He believes that there is such a thing called Western civilization. He believes there are ideas and that there are particularly smart, endowed, trained people who should lead based on those ideas. And that's how he defines leadership.
We're talking with Jeremy Suri, author of the new book, Henry Kissinger and the American Century. We welcome your questions about Henry Kissinger and his influence on foreign policy, or anything else for that matter. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 20 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Wednesday, July the 11th. John Munson is in for Kathleen Dunn today. After 9 o'clock, President Bush has again asserted executive privilege in the investigation of the firing of 8 U.S. attorneys. After 9, John and his guest will discuss executive privilege, the White House subpoenas, and the potential legal showdown between Congress and the administration. That's coming up in our next hour. We're talking with Jeremy Suri during this hour. He's a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a senior fellow at the Center for World Affairs and the Global Economy, the author of Henry Kissinger and the American Century. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Before we go to the phones, Professor Suri, any reaction from Henry Kissinger since your book was published?
He did try to get me to give him an advance copy, and I didn't. I said it was one of the hardest things I ever had to deal with. And in fact, I had my publisher tell him that. So he didn't get an advance copy. I got a message from his assistant that he has acquired a copy now and read it. But she didn't tell me what he's thought about it yet.
You don't think he's going to like it?
I'm not sure. I hope that he'll recognize I try to be fair, that I'm critical, but I'm also in some places praising, that I tried to understand him and that I treated him seriously as an intellectual, as a thinker and a policymaker. But I think he has trouble with criticism, as anyone would in his position. So I think there are parts he'll like and parts he won't like.
Yeah. It's hard to write. Do you consider this a biography?
It is and it isn't. I consider it an attempt to understand why he did what he did, mm-hmm. not to cover every detail of his life. I decided very early on I wanted to write a 350-page book, not a 2,000-page book. And in fact, we know a lot of the details of what he did. What we don't have, or what we didn't have until I wrote this, I thought was an explanation of why. So it's an interpretive biography. It covers most of his life, but it isn't about every detail.
Yeah. I did read one very positive review that said your book was refreshingly brief.
Oh, yes.
We have a number of calls, so let's go to the phones. Daniel in Rice Lake is first. Hi, Daniel. You're on the air.
Hello. It's incongruous to me that Nixon, the Cold War warrior, would be the first president to travel to China, which was strongly opposed by conservative Republicans. Was the opening of Red China a policy conceived of and promoted by Kissinger?
That's a great question, Daniel. Yes, but both Kissinger and Nixon, and in fact many others, deserve credit for that. By the late 1960s, it was quite clear that whoever was going to be the next president after Lyndon Johnson was going to make some move toward China. In fact, Lyndon Johnson had already started to do that in 1966. He gave a couple of speeches about this and had in fact tried to pursue openings to China, but China was convulsed by Cultural Revolution in the late 1960s. When Nixon and Kissinger came into power, they both recognized this needed to be done for two reasons: for help in Vietnam, and because China and the Soviet Union were about to go to war. In fact, almost did go to war on their border in 1969, and it made sense for the United States to work with the Chinese against the Soviets. It made sense for the United States to have better relations with both states than they had with each other. If Humphrey had been elected, Humphrey would have tried to do the same thing, I think. The writing was on the wall. I look at it, quite honestly, in the way I look at Iran today. I think whoever is going to be the next president is going to try to make some initiative towards Iran. It makes no sense that we have no relations with the government of Iran, especially when we have 140,000 Americans next door right now. The same was true with China in the late 1960s. So Nixon and Kissinger deserve credit, but we shouldn't pretend that they were the only ones who would have done this.
Yeah. What are Henry Kissinger's most notable, if not greatest, whatever word you want to use, accomplishments when it comes to foreign policy?
I would point to three. One, I would say, with regard to China, he did find a way to get this done, to open relations with China and establish a dialogue that created a basis for not just a normalization of relations, but what have been relatively productive relations between what now are the two major world powers, the United States and China. He deserves credit for that. I think he deserves credit for putting together the only peace agreement in the Middle East that we've had in the last 40 years. It is Henry Kissinger who, at the end of the 1973 war, begins a series of extraordinary shuttle diplomatic missions that I discuss in the book that produce, in the end, an agreement between Israel and Egypt, the Camp David Accords, actually signed during the Carter presidency in 1978. The Camp David Accords that Kissinger really put together provide a basis for peace between Israel and Egypt that has lasted with all the other turmoil in the Middle East, and there are problems with the Israeli-Egyptian relationship. Nonetheless, there's a peaceful relationship between those two sides. Imagine how much worse it would be, Joy, if we were back to 67 or 56 mm-hmm. and Israel and Egypt were going to war. And then the third thing I would point to is that Henry Kissinger, for all the problems with his worldview, he had a coherent international vision. And his coherent international vision structured the use of American power not just for war but for diplomacy. He conducted wide-scale diplomacy with people of all different backgrounds and societies, and the United States was able to operate more effectively because of that. We've lost that ability to operate as good diplomats today, I think.
Bob in Wauwatosa is with us now. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi. Very fitting that you just talked about the 1973 war. That's my question on Kissinger's role in forming U.S. policy, and there are really 3 points I'd like to hear what Kissinger's part was. The third point at the end, I have read that there was a ceasefire and the Israelis wanted to keep on fighting to improve their position, and Kissinger told them, go ahead and fight one more day. Point two is that the U.S. was, Nixon put our country on a I believe it was a DEFCON 3 nuclear alert to the point that we had atom bombs up flying in the planes. And point number one is that supposedly Israel was running out of ammunition and arms at the beginning, and Nixon supposedly broke NATO rules to send NATO supplies to Israel. And I'm curious how this policy was formed. Was that Nixon's policy, or was that Kissinger influencing Nixon? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Those are great questions, and I'll just take them in the order in which you put them out, where you started with the ceasefire. Basically, toward the end of the fighting, once the Israelis have reversed their early battlefield disastrous losses, they are in a position, as they move into Egyptian and Syrian territory, they are in a position to take a lot more. And they really want to push for this. In particular, Ariel Sharon and Moshe Dayan are pushing Kissinger on this. He is doing everything he can to get the Israelis to stop fighting. Once they turn the tide in the battle and they actually push back the Egyptian and Syrian forces, he wants that to be the end. He wants to negotiate a ceasefire at that moment. Now, he does. He does allow the Israelis to fight another day. That is true. But that was not what he wanted. That was really Israeli pressure, at least my reading of the materials. And he was doing everything he could to get the war stopped. And in fact, the criticism most Israelis have of him is that he didn't let them win the war. After their early losses. But that's a highly contested point. That's my reading of the documents. It's really, there's so many communications going on and so many contradictory things being said during this moment of heightened crisis. It is a little difficult to follow, but I don't think Kissinger is trying to help the Israelis take more territory at that time. You're absolutely right, Bob. Your second point about the nuclear alert. At the end of October, I think it's around October 24th or so, the Soviets threaten, as the Israelis turn the tide in the battle, the Soviets threaten to send their own forces in to support the Egyptians and the Syrians. The Egyptians had gotten rid of Soviet forces before the war. The Soviets threatened to intervene in the region. And Kissinger, and this is a really important point, Kissinger, without the president's explicit approval, without the president being involved, raises the American nuclear alert, what's called DEFCON, as you said, DEFCON 3, bringing us to the point just short of a nuclear war. He does this to try to, and in fact successfully, discourage the Soviets from intervening in the region. But this is a big, big moment because he's doing this without the president's approval. Why does he do it without the president being involved? Well, because Nixon at this time is so mired in Watergate. Nixon is not involved. Nixon does not even come to the meeting where this decision is made by Kissinger and Haig. So it's an enormous decision at many levels. It's something we have to think a lot more about. Who should have authority to do that sort of thing? What happens when the president is out of commission? And what are the implications of someone other than the president making that kind of decision? And then the final point, this relates to your final point, who's actually making policy? With regard to the 73 war, I think it's accurate to say that by the end of the war, Kissinger is actually making this policy himself. It makes it all the more complicated. Here again, you have a Jewish mm-hmm. Secretary of State making American policy toward the Arab-Israeli conflict with very little input from the president, quite honestly, because the president at that point is so caught up in Watergate, he's really not paying attention.
A related question from Dave in Wanakee. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. In 1971, Sadat offered Israel a full peace treaty in with the proviso that Israel would withdraw from the occupied territories, and they were mainly concerned with the Sinai. And Israel rejected that and instead expanded settlements into the Sinai, and it led to the 73 war. And this was Israel's rejection of it was in line with policy established by Kissinger. They ended up fighting a war over it, and years later accepted the same thing that Egypt had offered initially. And I would like to know what Kissinger's role was in rejecting it, which led to the 73 war.
That's a great question, Dave. It's not, it's definitely true that Sadat from 1970 on is actually trying to get the United States involved on his side. And he later says that he launched the war in 73 to actually get the United States into the region more actively. And he does push for a number of peace overtures, what he calls peace overtures in 71, including, as you said, a withdrawal from an Israeli withdrawal from some of the occupied territories. But the problem is that, yes, the Israelis rejected, but also the Egyptians are not really proposing peace as well. They never, in the 71 offer and any offer before the end of the 73 war, they never agreed to recognize the legitimate existence of the State of Israel. And that's a big deal for the Israelis, understandably. And the Israelis will not feel secure until they get that. And in fact, it's not when they get that from Egypt that makes them feel secure. It's that the United States at the end of the 73 war says, we will come in and protect your security in a way they never, the United States never did before. Just take the issue of foreign aid. American foreign aid toward Israel was less than $500 million in 72. After the 73 war, the United States is providing $2.7 billion in aid to Israel. That does not include a lot of military aid as well. So the big difference for Israel, and I'm not justifying the Israeli position, but the big difference for Israel is security guarantees from the United States that don't come with the 71 offers from Sadat. The Israelis are afraid if they give up the territory in 71 that Sadat will use that territory to launch another strike. And in fact, there is a sort of war going on of attrition already in 70-71 with battles short of full-scale war between Egypt and Israel. Both sides, Egypt and Israel, are not willing to compromise, I don't think, until after 73. I don't think Kissinger was really responsible for the lack of peace in 71. He had some influence on foreign policy in the Middle East, but actually that was the one area where William Rogers had a lot of influence. And Rogers, as I'm sure you know, Dave, was pushing for a peace plan of his own. Kissinger's not really managing the Middle East day-to-day until after the 73 war. It's the one area he pretty much stays away from, again, because of his Jewish background. It's the one area he writes almost nothing about before 1973.
Did I read in your book that Sadat and Kissinger had a very friendly, if not warm, relationship?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. These two men, after the 73 war, they had not met until November of 73, after the 73 war. They develop a very warm personal relationship, I think for two reasons among many. First is both of these men believed in making big decisions and making them quickly. Sadat, after 73, wanted to solve his problems with Israel, and he wanted to do it quickly, and Kissinger wanted that as well. The Israelis didn't, actually. They weren't so convinced they could solve their problems quickly. So that was one thing that brought Kissinger and Sadat together. The other thing was power. Kissinger recognized that Sadat was the only Middle East leader who could really control the radicals in his own society and elsewhere, because he was a dictator and because he had a certain legitimacy. And Sadat overrated Kissinger's power. Sadat, and I think, again, this is where his Jewishness mattered, Sadat constantly says in their meetings, you control Israel. And I think he's saying that to Kissinger not just because he's the American representative, but because Sadat believed that the Jews controlled American policy, Jews controlled Israel, and Kissinger was the top Jew. And so he thought that Kissinger was the person he should deal with.
With all of your meetings with Kissinger, is warm and friendly one way you would describe him?
Not at all. Not at all. He combines an extraordinarily intelligent mind. He's one of the smartest people I've ever met, and that shouldn't surprise anyone. He's obnoxious and aggressive. There's no small talk with him, even at 84, but he's also enormously charming. But what I would say I learned most in meeting him, and what taught me the most about how power works in Washington, and I mean, I'm sure in state government and elsewhere too, is his real genius is his ability to put together an argument in a way that even when you know he's wrong, you don't know how and where to argue with him. He puts together arguments in a way in which it makes it difficult to take a different position. And that's what he did throughout his career, is advising more powerful people. Mr. President, here are your options. But when he gives the president that memo, there's really only one option. That's Henry Kissinger's option.
That charm, or maybe it was the power, you briefly referenced it in your book. He had all sorts of glamorous, gorgeous women hanging around him. It was I remember that growing up and watching him on TV is like, well, I don't get it.
He was People Magazine's sexiest man alive in the early 1970s. And that's really hard to believe when you meet him personally.
Is that? I missed that one. Steve in Paddock Lake is with us. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, thanks for taking my call. I have heard over the years that Kissinger was designated as a war criminal by various foreign countries, and he's, if that is true, what are the countries and what are the specific charges against him?
He has not been indicted as a war criminal anywhere, but there are those who would like to indict him as a war criminal, and there is the possibility that in certain countries, including Spain, he could be, if he goes into the country, he could be subpoenaed, forced to testify, and not allowed to leave the country until he does that. And then no one knows what would happen after that, because there are pending cases where he is considered a material witness where war crimes are involved. And the Pinochet case is the biggest one. That's why Spain is a particularly difficult place for him to go, because there's an ongoing case about Pinochet, as I'm sure you know, Steve. And Kissinger is implicated in that, because the argument is that Pinochet comes to power in a coup that Kissinger helps, or at least supports, when he's in office. So there are charges out there, but they are not at the moment any government charge against him, and he has not been formally indicted anywhere. My opinion on this, to tell you the truth, is that he did a lot of horrible things, but he's not a war criminal, I don't think. And I would set the standard this way. I would say war criminals are those who engage in intentional destruction of people, intentional destruction of races, intentional destruction of ethnic groups. Genocide is, I think, what the standard should be for war crimes. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't say Kissinger did horrible things. He did horrible things with the bombing of Cambodia, did horrible things in supporting the coup in Chile. But unfortunately, that's what foreign policy is always about. This doesn't justify that. If we make him a war criminal, we're going to have to make every foreign policymaker a war criminal. And I just don't want to go down that route. Are we going to go after McNamara then? Are we going to go after Zbigniew Brzezinski? Are we going to go after George Shultz? I think that's a terrible route to go down. And I quite frankly don't think Kissinger was any worse than those other guys.
Thank you, Steve. Jim in Pleasant Prairie is with us now. Hi, Jim.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, and a very interesting show. My question is, America now has its leg caught in a trap of its own design that in the 20th century took on the label of Iraq. Dr. Kissinger is the only foreign policy heavyweight from previous administrations that has approved of this misadventure from the get-go. My question simply is why, and I will take my answer off the air.
Why what?
Jim's question was why Kissinger supported the war in Iraq when many other people like James Baker did not. James Baker, Brent Scowcroft, other people, especially those around Bush Sr., did not. It's a great question, and there's no doubt Kissinger did support the war, and actually was and still is advising the president on the war. In fact, Kissinger is the only person, I think, who does not work for the Bush administration now who has open entree to the president's office, meaning that anytime Kissinger is in Washington now, and he goes, you know, at least once or twice a month, he can call the president's secretary, and if the president is in his office, he can come and see him. No one else who doesn't work for the president can do that. In fact, most people who work for the president can't do that. So why has he supported this after the experience of Vietnam? It's a great question. I think we have to be clear on what he supported. He has supported going to war to overthrow Saddam Hussein and to eliminate what he sees as a source of instability in the Middle East. He never supported the idea of democratizing Iraq. Never believed, as Paul Wolfowitz and Don Rumsfeld did, that this could happen overnight. Kissinger doesn't believe that democracy is possible in that area in any short-term range. He doesn't believe democracy would lead to stability, as we talked about before. And he also was against doing this unilaterally. He said to me, and written in places like the Washington Post, that this should have been done as a more multilateral effort with better diplomacy, especially with countries like Turkey and India, which in the region had a strong interest in supporting us. So he hasn't been uncritical. He would have fought the war differently, but he still would have fought the war. And I think it comes back to his view of international politics. He believes, and I think he might be wrong on this, but he believes that Saddam Hussein's regime was a source of instability in the Middle East, and that you could not have a stable American-led Middle East without the elimination of that regime. And so he supported overthrowing that regime. But he did not support the way this was done. I think he was still wrong to start with, but we can't necessarily blame him for all the other mistakes this administration has made.
So we can presume that he supports the Bush administration right now in sticking with the surge and not withdrawing troops.
Yeah, well, I think, and he's been public about stating that he doesn't think that withdrawing at this point makes things any better. Now we are in the same position he was in Vietnam, where he believes our credibility is at stake, and if we withdraw and things get worse, it makes things even worse for us in the world. So this is, you know, once you're involved, you've got to do it right. But I still think he would have done things differently. I think, and I don't think it would have necessarily been better, but I think if he had been making policy, for example, when we went into Iraq, we would not have gone in and simply presumed we could overthrow this regime and that democracy would spring up. What I think Kissinger would have done is very early on looked for some regime of strong men who could put order in the society. It wouldn't look pretty, but it would be a more ordered situation. I'm not advocating that, but I think there'll be a very different kind of war.
Yeah. You had mentioned that he didn't support the attempt to have a Western-style democracy in Iraq, in part because he's skeptical of democracies.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, he said to me in one of my interviews when I was pushing him on this, and I think he said this elsewhere too, he said the worst thing we could have would be elections there. Do you really want to have fair elections in Pakistan tomorrow? Do you really want to have fair elections in Saudi Arabia? He's got a point, it seems to me.
We're talking with Jeremy Suri, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, author of Henry Kissinger and the American Century. We welcome your thoughts, your questions about Henry Kissinger and Henry Kissinger's legacy. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Hoping you'll stay tuned. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn from 9 until 11, talking in his first hour about executive privilege, the White House subpoenas, and the potential legal showdown between Congress and the administration over the assertion of executive privilege in the investigation into the firing of 8 U.S. attorneys. That's coming up. John Munson filling in for Kathleen Dunn after 9 o'clock. We're talking with Jeremy Suri. He is the author of the new book, Henry Kissinger and the American Century. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Let's take Alex in Milwaukee next. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Good morning, Joy, and good morning to the guests. Excellent, excellent program, excellent topic. I hope the guest makes the public radio circuit around the country. I'm interested in the relationship between Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski, and how Kissinger viewed Brzezinski. And I see them quite often on television now, but I wonder how did their relationship evolve over time. And I'll listen on the radio. Thank you.
Well, there's a fan.
Yeah, well, that was great. Yeah. I need to hire him as a publicist. Alex asks a great question. Kissinger and Brzezinski go back a long way. In fact, they were both at Harvard together as graduate students, even as young faculty members there. And they were longtime rivals. They were longtime rivals because they were two smart guys who were very ambitious, two outsiders to American policy, trying to make their way in. And so they were rivals and didn't get along for that reason. But secondly, they disagreed profoundly and continue to disagree on one big issue, and it reflects their backgrounds again. Kissinger is a German Jew. Brzezinski is a Polish non-Jew. And this is really important. For Brzezinski, American policy in the Cold War had to emphasize, above all, improving the lives of people within the Soviet Empire. He grew up in Poland. He felt connected to the satellite countries that were dominated by the Soviet Union, and that was a primary issue for him. That is why Brzezinski and Carter, one of the reasons they gave so much emphasis to human rights. For Kissinger, the way people lived within the Soviet Empire was an important issue, but it wasn't his primary issue. His primary issue was maintaining and creating a structure of stability that would protect Western civilization, would protect the good Germany and the good German ideas that had been lost, would protect the lives of Jews who were living outside the Soviet Empire. And you can see this profound difference, particularly on the issue of Jewish emigration from the Soviet Union. This becomes a big topic in the 1970s during the period of détente. Many Americans begin to push for and ask why the Soviets are not allowing more Jewish dissidents to leave the Soviet Union. And of course, Senator from Washington, Henry Scoop Jackson, and his assistant, Richard Perle, make this a big, big issue. Kissinger is against jeopardizing diplomatic agreements with the Soviet Union for the purpose of pushing for Jewish emigration, even though he's a Jew himself. And it's because for him, the concerns of East European Jews are actually not his primary concern, and the lives of people within those societies are not his primary concern. He cares, but he cares more about agreements between states that will provide for stability and protection against violence. For Brzezinski and others, human rights matter more in this context, and Brzezinski, one of the first things he does when he comes in as Carter's advisor, is push for a change of policy there. So on the issue of human rights and the role of internal issues, Brzezinski and Kissinger differ for a long time and continue to differ when you see them on, the Jim Lehrer show or whatever. That's usually what they're arguing about, it seems to me.
You're going to make the public radio circuit talking about your book?
Well, we've been doing a lot of that. Mm-hmm. It's been fun. My wife's upset that I'm doing too much of that, but I enjoy it. I love the questions. This is great.
Yeah, we got some great questions here. Let me ask this question. The foreign policy decisions that were influenced by or made by Henry Kissinger over the past many decades, how much did that have to do with the 9/11 attacks? Why the terrorists attacked us?
Well, I think on both ends he had a great deal to do with that. First of all, the present structure of the Middle East, as we talked about before, is very much a legacy of what he did after the 73 war, and my book talks a lot about that. And much of the hatred of the United States in that area comes from the results of American action in the region after 73. Even when we were doing the right thing, like bringing peace between Israel and Egypt, that empowered Israeli occupation in certain territories. It empowered an Egyptian dictatorship. And that's part of the source of anger and discontent in that region. So his policies did contribute to that. And that's a failure that he has to live with, and we are unfortunately living mm-hmm. with. Post 9/11, I think his influence grew also because, quite frankly, after the Cold War, we devalued as a society the importance of foreign policy strategy and international diplomacy. We believed that we no longer had to put so much value in that, that what mattered most was economic relations and are simply using our power around the world. And the Bush administration immediately found itself in a situation where it needed to find people who could advise it on diplomatic relations with that part of the world. And quite frankly, I think this is a failure of our universities as well as our society. We don't train people very well anymore to make foreign policy and to think about international diplomacy. It seems too elitist. It seems imperialist. But for better or worse, we need people with Kissinger's minds, maybe with different policies, but we need people like that to advise on policy. And we don't encourage our smartest people to do that anymore. They become CEOs and Wall Street traders. They don't become diplomats. And so that's made his influence all the more great now because there are fewer people like him around.
He was tapped to chair the committee that was going to look into the response to the 9/11
right.
attacks. And then
right.
he he resigned because of his some interests he had?
Yes. He was looked to by, I think it was actually Cheney, who wanted to bring him in to head the commission to look into 9/11 preparedness and why we were not prepared. The commission that Tom Kane and Lee Hamilton eventually chaired and did a great job on. Kissinger couldn't take it. He really wanted that position. He really wants to make policy again. It's amazing. 84 years of age, he wants to be Secretary of State again. I'm absolutely certain of that. He had to give it up, though, because I think correctly, members of the Senate and elsewhere said, well, you cannot work for the governments you are studying as part of this commission. And what Kissinger does as an international consultant now through Kissinger Associates is he consults to countries and companies operating in the Middle East. So he works for the Saudi government, for example. So he had to give up the commission position because of that.
More callers. Matt in Viroqua. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you today?
Good.
Hey, I was curious if in any of your research and exploring Henry Kissinger, if you could speak to his involvement in the Bohemian Grove Society?
Yes. Bohemian Grove, that's a great question, Matt. Bohemian Grove is, it's actually this group that meets in Northern California once a year, I think, in the summer. I think it's maybe exclusively male. Maybe they have a few women now. And they meet for 3 weeks, I think. They go camping out. And it's supposedly the business and political elites who come together to drink and smoke cigars, but also to talk about the future of the world. And people like Colin Powell are part of this now. So we do know they at least have some African-Americans involved. It is the elite of the elite. And Kissinger went on numerous occasions. I don't know if he goes every year, but went on numerous occasions to talk to this group. But he's not a full-fledged member of it. Not because they don't want him to be a member, but because that's not his society. That's not him. He wants to influence those people. And when he goes, he's a celebrity there. There's no doubt. But he doesn't go and hang out, kick up his feet, drink beer, smoke cigars, sit around the campfire, and talk about the world. He goes and gives a lecture, pontificates, and leaves. And that's a really important point, I think. This is how he is still an outsider. He's enormously influential. They want him there. But he's not just one of the guys. He's not part of the Old Boys Network, even though he has influence in the Old Boys Network. That's really important, because that's why he can have influence but not have friends. And that's really where he stands in many of these issues. If you look at the worlds in which the people like the James Bakers operate in, it's a collegial world of policymaking. Kissinger's still an outsider to that world. He's still an outsider, even though he's an influential member of groups like the Bohemian Grove.
Yeah, never heard of it. Thank you very much, Matt, for the call. Tom in Stratford. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I am curious about Kissinger's view of Zionism. And that underpinning of the legitimacy of Israel, and how that then puts us on a sectarian footing there in a way. And does he keep arm's length from that, sort of, or...
All right.
That's a great question, Tom. Let me take it back to early in his life. He comes from a family of Orthodox Jews. He's raised as an Orthodox Jew, one of the most Orthodox families in Fert, the town he grows up in, one of the most Orthodox families in Washington Heights when he comes to New York. And it is a family that is not connected, does not support Zionist groups in either situation. There are active Zionists in Fert, where he grows up. Some people leave Fert, Germany, where he grew up, when the Nazis come to power and go to Palestine. He does not. His family does not do that. They don't really interact with the Zionists. Most of the Orthodox don't, in fact, in their community. So he is someone, in that sense, who kept the Zionists at arm's length. He did, in fact, have to interact with them because after 1935, the Nazis prohibited his father and prohibited him from interacting with non-Jewish groups. So he had to leave the public school and leave the public sports academy and actually join the Zionist youth group so he could play soccer. That's just a sort of side story. He, throughout his life to the present, is not someone active in Zionist circles. But I don't think he's anti-Zionist either. I think he views the state of Israel maybe not as a religious mission for Jews. I don't think he associates that, but I think he sees it as something politically useful and practically necessary for Jews in the world. So for him, I think it's a matter of international politics. But I don't think he's ever been, and I haven't seen any evidence of him having any great intellectual association with Zionism. Like many other Orthodox Jews of his background, he believes Jews should worship as Jews, but should publicly interact as members of the societies they're in, as Americans or as Germans. And his family thought of themselves as Germans, not Jews who were not Germans. They thought of themselves as Germans and Jews. And Kissinger today thinks of himself as an American and a Jew. And the German and the American always come first in that sense. So he's not anti-Zionist, but he's not particularly pro-Zionist either.
Well, we're running short on time, but let's see if we can get another caller or two in. Bernice in Crystal Lake. Hi, you're on the air.
Do you think that Kissinger, as a global businessman, for instance, he couldn't get one government post because he wouldn't reveal his business clients, really was primarily interested in securing natural resources of countries really cheaply? For instance, his involvement in Chile shows that, you know, that he wrecked that government and copper industry went over to a U.S. corporation. And another thing about Kissinger was that after he talked to Golda Meir in Israel, who was a premier there then at one time, she said, well, there'll never be peace in Israel. And that was after she talked to Kissinger. So do you think that he was really a global businessman in the interests of his client corporations?
All right. Are those two connected?
I think so, yeah. I think and I appreciate those questions. I think, first of all, we have to be clear. He was not working as a global businessman at all until after he left office in 1977. Now, the problem is he continues to advise the government and has business interests now. So I think that's a fair question post-77. But until that time, he actually was not someone who enriched himself in office. When he leaves office, he's not wealthy in 1977. And the one thing that should be said about Kissinger is he's incredibly knowledgeable about most issues except economics. He spends very little time thinking about those issues when he's in office. I think he's always been concerned about natural resources, but I don't think that's driven him in the same way that security and international order have. But, of course, those serve economic interests as well.
Yeah, we're almost just out of time, but Marianne in Milwaukee has an interesting story. Marianne, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to add to this. I don't know how many people you were able to interview from way back in his life, but I had a friend who went to grade school with Henry Kissinger.
Oh, wow.
And she in Munich, and she said that he was just the same then as he is. She didn't like him then. She didn't like him as a child. And
he had those glasses and that deep voice in grade school.
You know, that's wonderful, Marianne. I probably didn't talk to your friend. I did talk to a number of people, especially in Germany, who knew him from grade school, and they said pretty much the same thing. I will say in my book, one of my great finds is a picture of him from when in his school boy days, and you should buy the book to see the picture. And that he looks the same facially, but he's thin. And it's really strange to see a thin Henry Kissinger, almost scrawny. I should also say that when people mention that he was just the same, I'm sure that's true, but I think he's such an iconic figure of our world today. That sort of filters back into our memories, doesn't it?
We are at the end of the hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Very interesting. Jeremy Suri, author of Henry Kissinger and the American Century. Thanks to Carmen Jackson and Karen Prager for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.